Hey, welcome back, everybody, to our another edition of our Hometown Heroes. Got an exciting episode for you today. A lovely young lady, Miss Loris Edwards, is joining us today, and we're going to talk about her incredible journey that's chronicled in her book, Journey from the Land Under the Cross, which is available in most bookstores. Was published by Miss Loris last year with some help from some of our good friends here in Central Texas, a veteran of the Hometown Heroes himself, Mr. Carl Kirkendall, among others that have helped Miss Loris with this book. So we'll talk about your journey and some highlights from the book itself. But welcome, Miss Loris, to another edition of Hometown Hero.
Well, I think you're saying too much when you say Hometown Hero. I'm just some little old woman that's living here and that has some thoughts on things that happened in her life.
Well, so you've lived an amazing 94 years, is that right?
Yes, 94. You wouldn't believe it. You know, every night I ask God, why am I here? But then in the morning I wake up and I know it's not purgatory because it looks too comfortable and it's my bedroom. So I think God does not negotiate.
No.
He does what he wants to do.
He has a plan for
yes.
all of us. So give us a little bit, a Reader's Digest version, if you will, of growing up. I'm not going to try to pronounce Salacia, is that right?
That is correct pronunciation.
You
did very well.
So give us a little Reader's Digest, you know, of growing up.
I think what I most remember, I remember the little stories because I think it was amazing that God has a sense of humor because he gave two very orderly, very well-thinking people an enterprising child like me. So, may I just tell you what the book came about?
Sure.
And basically, I wanted to show that God can be in our life, and once he is in our life, our life is turned to the good, and you can be rich and have God and heaven raised by values and mm-hmm. according to the commandments, and you embrace it with the joy. You know, I remember my upbringing as happy, and I was nicely corrected, but I was corrected.
Mm-hmm.
And later in life, no child is happy when they have rules.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I was a child, you know, that we weren't allowed to break rules. It didn't even occur to me, but I had to look around how to get around things.
Yeah.
And that very often was not successful. And even from early childhood, you know, I learned the lessons well. I had two amazing parents and that had the time to raise me, that I grew up under Hitler and Nazism in a deeply religious home. My mother was Franciscan educated. My father was Jesuit educated, which made him very suspect to the mm-hmm. political time. But they held to it. And, you know, God was just in our house. If I'd have looked up from the breakfast table and my father would have said, look up and there sits God, I would not have been surprised. He was a present, but he was a joyful presence.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't scolding, there was just a gentle example. And I thought it was necessary for people to see that God is with you.
Mm-hmm.
And as it later turned out, when we had to leave our home and we went through a lot of hardship, that when you keep God in your life, you have a goal and you have a helper. in good times and in bad times, and he will give you what you need, even though you don't know at the time what it is that you need.
Right. You mentioned the faith and growing up, and one of the things that comes crystal clear through your book is that your parents, they truly lived their faith. They truly lived the Catholic life that we always hear and are taught as youngsters.
You know, they did, and they did in, you know, not in a scolding way. We had two maids and a housekeeper at that time. And in school, many little children were able to boss the help around. Mm-hmm. And in our house, that wasn't possible. I had just three more adults to listen to. And it's amazing how these adults worked together, because there were no instructions heard. Mm-hmm. People did the right things at the right time. I think a lot of that had to do with my mother. My mother was very kind. She was determined in certain things, mm-hmm. but she was very kind and always cheerful. And she thanked people whom she employed for every little deed that they did for us. Uh-huh. And so everybody, I don't want to be like Pollyanna here. I mean, I was corrected. I know our housekeeper that I had to listen to and that had the rule of the house because my mother was very ill very often. Mm-hmm. But when I stood around, you know, they said I had two big ears. I was everywhere. Something was going on. And when I stood around, she would say, "Missy, you have something to do. I can give you something." But what she gave was usually dusting, which I hated. So she made a lifetime reader out of me, because I would grab a book and sit down, and I said, I'm reading. And she said, "Well, that's all right."
Yeah, you describe yourself as precocious, I believe is the word you use. And I think that's one of the big differences between little boys and little girls, because a little boy would have been described as being a mischievous or a troublemaker. But yet in the book, it's wonderfully written, and I love what, and you and I have talked about this before, but I love that the fact that you're telling a history of your family and your a little bit about your life, but it's not that sometimes dry history story, and then we did this, and then we did this, and then we did this. You really kind of have captured a series of short stories that you've put into this book that tell your life and tell about the growing up and the lessons that you learned from your parents. Do you think that you were always aware of those lessons that you were learning from them?
Most of the time in a different way, you know. Okay. I remember when my mother took all these expensive toys away, and she put the word out, I think, that nothing was to be rebought for me, that I had put up and lied to her three times. I really tried to save them from her cousin, who was a klutz. And every visit of his, some of my little things were broken or damaged or not as nice as I had kept them. I was a neatnik even as a child. And so she gathered them up and took them to the orphanage. And at the time, I didn't learn the value of it as I saw it later. But I did know that lying is not profitable. You know, kids lie because they want to get something, mm-hmm. or they want to get out of something. Well, I learned very clearly that didn't work in our house. And sharing was expected as a way of life. And my mother said it was almost funny that I would take little things after that and try to press them on the maids. And I would ask him, you know, "I'm a sharer, can't you see that?" And then they said, well, in our house, the mister decides who is the share. So I quit being so generous. But, you know, it stayed with you. And in our very hard times, and that story is not in the book, but in our very hard times when bread was hard to have and we were really starving. That's a hard word to say, but you know, gnawed in your stomach. And whenever there was bread, my mother would share it, because the only people we knew then were refugees like ourselves who had nothing. And as a teenager, it made me angry that there was a piece of bread left that I could have eaten. And she shared it with somebody that just came in. And she said, you know, sharing is the only thing that is left to me that makes me human. And I can't give that up. I cannot give it up even for you. I will always share. And one day, I think I was 15 or 16, I looked at her. And you know how you have parents, and they're parent people for most of us. You don't think of them as the person that's behind it. You think of somebody that's nourishing you, that's there for you, and they're your parent people, and you love them. But I looked into her face and her eyes when she said that, and for the first time, I could understand who she was. The woman that she was, the deep faith that she had. And I loved her in a way that I never loved her before.
That's a fascinating part of the whole story that you've got here. And you talk about being in your teenage years. And I'm going to a quote from your book here that I really like to hear you comment on. And it says, here I was at the threshold of my teens, wonderfully blessed with a most saintly parent, totally oblivious of her great merit and the grace it might bestow on me, unworthy as I was, resenting every moment of it. And it just made me think about, you wrote this 1940s, and here we are, you know, almost 100 years later, and it's still so apropos for many teenagers today, myself included, you know, who didn't realize or rather looked at the rules and the structure that were imposed upon us as being constricting and limiting. In reality, they were providing a boundary and a safe place for us to learn and grow individually and in our spiritual life as well.
You know, I know that 94-year-olds get boring because they want to tell other people how to live their lives that they themselves have maybe not been that successful in doing. But if I had, as a pedagogue and as a teacher and dealing with young people, I would think we get discouraged too easily. And if they appear not to listen, the lives that we live and what we tell them, they don't just go into their ears. They do go onto a tape in their brain. And, you know, my great-grandmother used to say, I remember one time I was complaining because a little girl that I had been nice to was not nice to me. And my grandmother says, well, we do all these good things that we call virtue, and we call them, we put them in a basket. God has a basket, and we do them to fill God's basket up. And then when our time comes, God will take out of the basket and give it to us. Not necessarily what we put in, but what others put in, and God gives it back to us. And I truly believe that it's happened in my life whenever I needed help. Either my parents' good training was there to help me, that at the time I didn't understand. Later I understood it in a deeper way. And it helped form me.
Beautiful. It's beautiful. You you open your book with a comment about that it was more that what your family lost was more than just the land. That it was everything from your culture and your background and, you know, your heritage, but that stayed with you, as you said, you know, in the imprinted in your brain. So you still carry some of that with you as you went through the rest of your life.
It becomes who you are, you know. And I remember people are surprised sometimes what I remember so clearly. But when we got into bad times, you know, when we became refugees, we had to leave the land. And then we came into the West. And you didn't understand 14 million refugees came into a Germany at that time in the West that was totally bombed out. How could they have been happy to receive these people? Sure. But, you know, some things you remember. We would, two or three girls would go down a street, and I remember one time they used to hang their wash outside on lines, you know. A woman saying, hanging out of the window and shouting to her daughter, get the wash off the line, some refugees are coming. Oh. So, you know, things like that sometimes are very hard to forget.
Sure.
But my mother's faith always said everything was forgiven when Jesus died on a cross. Mm. Don't hold grudges. And she had these little ways of teaching that. She said, you know, if you hold things, bad things, it's like all of us have a backpack. And you hold these bad things that are done to you or that you think are done to you, and you put them in that backpack. Mm-hmm. And finally that backpack gets too heavy to carry.
Yeah.
And then it'll tear you down and you'll be on the ground. She says, you have to live life taken out of the backpack so that your life will be lighter because God is going ahead of you and you're going into his footsteps.
Yeah.
So these things I do remember, and they helped me a lot. They helped me to forgive. You know, this is not a history of a world history. This is a history of an individual that had to suffer these things. And culturally, I'm so much of the land in which I was raised and the family that raised me. And, you know, when the land was ceded after the Potsdam meetings, I think, it's not that you hated Polish people. You just hated a world where this could be taken away from you. Where you left a key in a door and you left the house and every lease possession you ever had and you left the land. Everybody was scattered. You didn't have family anymore. You had next to nothing. I had a very ill mother that was a great treasure that God gave me, but at the time you were more heard about the people that you lost. None of the men of our family came back.
Mm-hmm.
That entire life was separated and torn apart. And you had to deal with that. I remember being angry in the morning. My mother would wake me up. And I wrote a poem about it. I would tell my mother, I'd say, why should I be happy? Look around you. What do we have? One little wobbly table, one chair for two people, one bed, four walls. Look around. That's all we had. And then I do remember I didn't want to acknowledge it when she said it. You know, I thought that she doesn't understand how bad life is, you know. I would be angry with her. I said, you don't even cry for what we've lost. And one time she told me, She said, "You are a child of love and grace. Your father's love and mine that went into your making, and God gave his grace. And that is a gift. And you make the joy. Joy doesn't come from the outside.
Amen.
Joy comes from your inside. Yeah. And then you go out and share it." And I told her, "You're delusional." You know, that what's, it's very, by that time I had a little job, as I said in the book. And a teenager with a little job and money in their hand, when the family doesn't make money, is very dangerous because they think they're very important.
Mm-hmm.
And they feel free to tell their parents what to do. So I think these are the things I'm going to sit in purgatory for. The, you know, the suffering that came to my mother from what came out of my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And but she was very right, and it stayed with me. So
there's a thread that I think, and we talked about this before too, but there's a thread that runs through the entire book, and it's all about forgiveness. And so you mentioned, you know, that the terrible things, and using your words, the terrible things that came out of your mouth towards your mother. And even though you describe her as being very sick, she still seemed to me to be a very strong woman.
Yes.
I mean, health concerns aside, to bring a daughter across that you know, terrible divide to get into the West, and then all the way eventually to the United States. Despite all her health conditions, she was still a pretty strong woman.
You know, she had, I always looked at her, and when I got smart enough to understand who she was, I looked at her and it was like she had an unbreakable relationship with her God.
Mm-hmm.
And she lived in a different world, and it saved her, it served her well. Because, you know, we all want salvation. She prayed for the people that beat and raped us, and was always cheerful. She managed to, she have an inner glow and an inner voice.
Yeah.
And once I, you know, understood that, I loved her with a love you can't believe. She always thought of herself last, but then she had the help she needed, when, because people could see that and people were attracted to her. It, you know, she lost her husband, she lost her son, she lost her only brother, she lost all her relatives, everything she had.
Mm-hmm.
And I was saying to a friend the other day, something got lost, and I said, my mother always said, whatever's lost or broken, what money bought, it can buy it again, or mm-hmm. we can live without it.
Mm-hmm.
And she lived by these maxims, and they, you know, she always helped, and she said, it's how we see things and what we see, where we see poverty, where we see a broken heart, we're responsible for, to help. And I remember, and I put that in a book, when I was 13, asking her, how do you always see so much? And she said she was praying for a larger vision. And I said, oh my goodness, she prays it up every night. We're going to be doing her charities forever. And so, you know, and I can tell you, I see a lot of things, but I don't pray them up. I think my mother prays them up for me in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it, there's a truth in it, you know.
She it makes me think of a quote that you recount here in the book, where she says, "You have a loving God who looks out for us, but he expects us to cooperate."
Yes, that was a maxim in our house when we had everything that still was expected.
Yeah. Beautiful, beautiful. Yeah. What other What else do you want people to take from this book?
You know how hard it is sometimes to forgive and how it is a work. You have to begin to think about forgiveness and you have to ask God to help you. That is not a road you can walk by yourself. Mm-hmm. You tell God, I'm willing to forgive, but it's hard. Because, you know, as I grew older and my profession put me in the way of many people who had things that were difficult in their lives. And if you forgive it one time, that's not enough. Because the consequences of the act that you wish to forgive continue on and you have to live with these consequences. Mm-hmm. And you have just forgiven everything. And there it pops up again, you know. So you have to continue to forgive.
Yeah.
So that you, not, you know, from some great principle even, that you forgive the other person. It has nothing to do with them. It has everything to do with you in order for you to live a free life.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be able to shake that burden away from you, and the only way you can do it by forgiving it and saying, I put it in the heart of God, and to let him help me, and lo and behold, something pops up, and there you're mad about it again. You know, and there you stand, and you said, well, yesterday I was good, look at me today. And then you have to say, well, God, you know, I have fallen, put it in the fall that you had on a cross, on the way to the cross, and help me back up again, and help me to think of this with a loving heart and let it go and forgive it. And I can tell you, some of it you can free yourself, and you live a better life. And that's what I wanted to show, to maybe help someone in a book, that it doesn't matter how much you have or how little you have, and or in between, that God can take all these things and bring them to good. For one thing, because of how I was tossed around, I wound up working as an interpreter translator that was licensed for a multinational defense pact tank training center, where I finally met my husband. And I always wrote stories. I used to be editor for a small magazine when we were overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband always said, you can write your stuff, but I'm a private man. I fought three wars for my privacy. I don't want to be in them. But I do have to tell you that I had a good life with the best husband God could have given me, that I would never have found had I not been tossed to where I was tossed.
Sure.
It wasn't by my design, because that's not what I thought I would be doing for my life. And when I was young, you know, I cried that I was not able to do what I had wanted to do, because I always, you know, hung a gnaws in your stomach, and to fill your stomach, you have to take jobs.
Mm-hmm.
That was always, you know, I had to look for how I could support my mother and myself. And to get an education was very difficult, which God made possible for me, that I was able to do these things. And I would never have met my husband if I hadn't been where I was at the time. And it was a good marriage. And actually, the book is a fruit of it, because my husband had heart disease and dementia, and I was able to take care of him in our house for 6 years. But that's a difficult task, and I had to free myself. And I had to remember, how did I come from there to here, and what's in my heart that needs to go, so I can be ready to give him everything I had.
Mm-hmm.
And while I had him on a baby monitor, I'd sit in my office and I'd write these little stories that made the book. And then when everything happened with the Ukraine,
Yeah.
Some of my friends said, you know, some of these things you talk to us about, you should publish them. They might help someone that is hurt like you were. And so my friend Carl Kirkendall helped me to do, because publishing had changed from the time when I was young and I was editor. It was a totally new world.
Sure.
That he guided me through.
You mentioned your husband and his desire for privacy, but I love this little snippet of advice that where you say in my mind I hear him say as often that he was wont to do, let it go, it's over with. We have life, we have God and each other, friends, music, and laughter. We are so rich. And I think that that's something that that's something, you know, should be written on on our gravestone or something. You know, we are so rich when we stop to think about the little blessings that God has given us. But I think at times maybe it's our human nature. I don't know. We get too wrapped up in all the minutia, the things that we don't have, and we lose track of some of those things. And I thought that was a great piece of advice from your husband.
Yeah, that's how he was during his life. You know, I'd come home and I'd worry about something, and he said, let it go, let it go. This is our home, and we're not going to discuss these things. You can talk to me about them, but mm-hmm. our house has to be a safe place where we can be happy.
And that had to, later in life, that yeah. mindset had to carry you and serve you well when you were teaching here at St. Mary's.
Yeah? That was a joy, you know, that came almost by accident, because at the time I came to Texas, Beethoven could have not taught music in a Texas school. You had to have all these certificates. Mm-hmm. Now I had the degrees, but, you know, not the certificates. And the sisters lost a seventh grade teacher a mm-hmm. week before school.
Wow.
And so they asked me to undertake that. And I fell in love with junior high school kids. And my friend said I needed to have my brain examined. There weren't very many people that way. And, you know, my entire time at St. Mary's, I had cancer when I was a young woman mm-hmm. and didn't have children. And you have to listen very careful to answers that you, for your questions. I asked my husband before we got married, I'd at least have 5 children, because my father came from a very big family of mm-hmm. 8 children. And they weren't always the nicest people, but they were happy. Mm-hmm. They called and forgave, you know, and I loved them all. And they all were dispersed or dead. But, you know, I didn't want to write about the death and the beatings and the violence. You can turn on the television and you can see all that. That's not where the lessons are. That's not where the life is. That's not where the beauty of it is. But St. Mary's was a great blessing to me. And I finally got everything I needed to become principal and enjoyed, you know, if the wildest kid came to my car in the morning to help me carry my books, my day was made no matter what had happened before.
So you taught seventh grade for how many years?
I think, you know, it gets a little fuzzy when you're my age, but about 2 or 3 years, and then I became assistant principal, you okay. know, while I got myself the necessary documents, and then for 26 years I was principal.
26 years.
Yes.
There's a whole book worth of stories right there. I guess when you get the energy, you can write some more tales about your time as a principal at St. Mary's.
You know, as long as we realize that kids are kids and being formed, mm-hmm. and we can't expect them to be adults, and that's a good thing because adults sometimes don't act like they should. I always think when people come and say, a cafeteria where kids are so loud. Well, in my estimation, it's less loud than when you go to some cafes that adults sit in.
We
have to keep our perspective and right. remember these people are growing and we're there to help them grow.
What an amazing opportunity, though, to be a principal for a generation worth of children, to be a part of their, as you said, molding and shaping and forming their little minds.
You know, you have to be very grateful, and you have to tell yourself any morning, please, God, don't let me hurt where I want to help. Mm-hmm. Because you need all the help you can get, and you need God's help and the saints and angels and every moment of your day. Mm-hmm. And then be aware of what you're doing. But it's funny, you know, sometimes I go to church and some bearded man will say hello to me and I think, oh, that's so-and-so that was in the eighth grade. You know, and it's nice to be greeted and they say hello.
But you remember them as a young eighth grader.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, I don't remember their name and I feel bad about it, but they don't look like nothing that what they looked like when I knew them.
Now, when you were there, eighth grade was as high as the school went, right?
Yes.
There wasn't a high school there,
No, so, there was no high school.
Yeah,
so. Holy Trinity was later, but grew out of St. Mm-hmm, Mary's. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So.
But you had to take, kind of circling back here to the book, many of the lessons that you've, and I'm sure many, many more that aren't described in your book here, that had to serve you well when you're dealing with the children at the school.
They did help me, you know, and sometimes I would share something with them. You know, you children as they're growing, sometimes somebody bullies them or something. What happens sometimes is share a secret with somebody and then the person would say, well, you know, then I would tell that what you told me. And so I would tell him the story that happened to me when I would allowed some boys to copy from me.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I got tired of it, because when I went to confession each week or other week, I would have to confess it, and then I was instructed to quit doing it. Mm-hmm. But then the next Monday when the boys came for the homework, I gave it up again. And so finally when I got courage enough to face them, you know, nobody ever threatened anything that didn't happen in the school that I went to.
Mm.
But they appeared like they would threaten you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I told the kids, guess what happened? And they would tell me two or three outcomes. And I said, no, nothing happened. When you face your challenger,
mm-hmm.
usually it goes away. You just have to get up enough do that.
Mm-hmm.
They asked me, well, you must have been very courageous. And I said, no, I got a bad cold and I thought it was a flu. And I thought God would punish me. I would die and God would punish me for letting the boys copy. And God was stronger than anything they could do to me. So I gathered up enough courage on Monday to not let them copy.
That's good. And God is stronger than anything they could do. That's good words. That's good words of
advice.
And I
told kids that.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. I want to just kind of close with really it's the last paragraph of the book, and I put about five big red circles around it because I think this is just it's a beautiful almost prayer, a final prayer that you've closed the book with. And if you don't mind, I'd like to read it for everybody. The way of the cross that leads to the life of my inheritance must traverse the truth of transforming forgiveness. I am nearly blind, Lord, and short of breath from hardness of heart. Take my hand, good God of my childhood, and bring me safely across the abyss. I think that is absolutely beautiful. And, I think that's something that we could all, a prayer that we should carry with us this Lent, and ask for the forgiveness that is the central part of your book. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. And I want to thank you for taking some time out of your busy calendar to sit down with me and share your book. The book, again, is called Journey from the Land Under the Cross. And Miss Loris Edwards, again, published last year. You can find it at most any book outlet, especially on the interwebs. I encourage everyone to go get a copy of this and read about true forgiveness, because I think that's the takeaway from your wonderful, wonderful book. Any final thoughts, Miss Loris?
Thank you, Tom, for thinking of it and inviting me. And I tell your audience what I told God. I said, God, I can't remember ever having been interviewed. I was very young when that happened. And so I know I'm going to make a fool of myself. Let me make a little fool of myself and not a big one. And so I hope you to listen to that charitably. And I thank you very much, Tom, for giving me the opportunity to talk about these things.
It was certainly my pleasure, and I truly enjoyed the book. And thank you very much, and God bless you.
And the same to you and to your audience. Thank you.